Lovers of the political theater get 2 extra hours of screen time today as the Democratic National Convention kicks off. This is the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. COVID cases in children are steadily increasing, says the CDC, and yet in-person classes have resumed in some Texas school districts. Airlines are losing money, but airlines are hoarding money. How those two can be true. Join us as we reimagine the U.S. Postal Service. This reimagining has to do with healthcare and wellness checks that could come along with your mail. Interesting? Yes, it's the Texas Standard. From deep in the heart of Texas, this is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. It's Monday, the 17th of August. So glad you could tune in. Lots of ground to cover. In a first of its kind, the Democrats are kicking off their national convention virtually today. We'll have more on that in a few minutes, but first, news over the weekend, the resignation of 2 officials at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, also known as the CDC, and also the news that CDC is now saying COVID cases in children are steadily on the rise, and yet not all school districts in Texas are postponing their start days or teaching the majority of their classes online. The Thrall Independent School District in Central Texas is part of a tiny town about 45 minutes away from the capital city. Kids there started school last week, most attending in person. Tommy Hooker is superintendent at Thrall ISD, and he joins us to talk about how the first week of classes went. Superintendent Hooker, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me about the first week of class. How was it?
The first week was so much easier to reflect on it now and say that it turned out very well. We had a lot of apprehension, and obviously being one of the first public school districts in Central Texas back, we had our reservations, and it turned out very well.
In the middle of a pandemic, I know that you had parents and teachers collaborating and speaking about this, but why was the ultimate decision to attend in-person classes?
We wanted to have in-person for several reasons. One is we're capturing kids' heart school. We believe in doing social contracts, and we did have to limit handshaking and things like that, but we feel like being able to see students eye to eye, and that is the way that they choose to learn as well. But our connectivity in rural Texas is very limited.
You mean internet connectivity?
Yes, and we have students who do not have that connectivity to be able to do lessons on a consistent basis. Furthermore, our staff, we have on average, a very experienced staff, and our teachers have a lot of years of experience, and the virtual learning is a challenge. We are making adjustments, and we are learning to be better at it, but it is a very huge challenge across the state.
So you have a total of over 700 kids, and what I want to talk about is the protocols that you put in place to maintain social distancing and, you know, make sure that students and teachers were safe.
That is correct. We had a task force that was put together from a local group of parents slash medical advisors slash administrative team members. And basically what they felt we needed to do in the protocol is, one, require every student and employee to wear a mask when possible at all times. The second thing was to maintain a minimum of 6 feet of social distance when possible. And the third thing, which was a unique request, but CDC says we should do that, is build in planned hand washing with soap stations throughout the district.
Now, I'm sure you have considered the possibility of cases popping up. I mean, the CDC now says that cases in children are steadily increasing, so it wouldn't be a surprise if you had any cases. What is the plan then?
Well, we have started that process, and we did have to practice quarantining. And so, you know, in the process of working through possibility of the spread happening, we're going to take a real strong stance to make sure that we do provide the virtual option in lieu of in-person if we suspect that anyone is not within those parameters of the protocol. And we check the temperatures daily. We monitor students, and we try to have the parents communicate with us often when they have either their child or even when a staff member is not feeling well.
So what you're telling me is that if there were cases and you need to shut down, you will shut down.
That is correct. But we're going to always start with the smallest group. We have essentially three levels. We are going to look at the immediate first line in our contact tracing that may have been affected, but limited to only a small group or a few students, potentially one class on the extreme. We have the next group that would be a campus, and we have three campuses in our district. And then if we cannot contain it to that campus, for example, if someone who tests positive has siblings on other campuses, then there is a chance that we could shut down the district in that situation. So we did extend our calendar, and we did build in breaks at 9 weeks. So at every 9 weeks, we did build in an additional nearly a week to do some recovery.
What are you doing with the 25% of students who are not attending?
Those students are doing virtual instruction 100% of the time.
We've been speaking with Tommy Hooker. He's the superintendent of Thrall ISD. The small school district began in-person classes last week, despite the current coronavirus pandemic. Superintendent Hooker, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. You're welcome.
The Democratic National Convention kicks off today with a two-hour virtual event built on the theme of unity. Former Vice President Joe Biden will officially be nominated as the Democratic challenger to President Donald Trump later this week. Recent polls show Biden in a virtual dead heat with Trump in Texas. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider looks at Biden's chances of carrying the state in November.
But for COVID, Carla Braley would be in Milwaukee today. The Houstonians are delegates of the Democratic National Convention. She was at home last Tuesday when the news broke that Joe Biden named Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate.
My daughter was exercising, who's 11 years old, and she couldn't figure out why I was like screaming. I was, oh my God, this is really happening.
As a Black woman, Braley says she was elated by the choice, and it'll make a big difference in her work getting out the vote this fall. Braley's also vice president of the Texas Democratic Party.
I think that we can do a good job of winning Texas locally. So a lot of my focus will be on precinct chairs, getting them involved, getting them the tools that they need.
Everything they need to compete. Rebecca Acuna is Biden's Texas state director.
We're working really hard to get our base to turn out in higher numbers, whether that's Latinos, African Americans, AAPI.
That's Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders.
We are focused also on women. We are also focused in getting our numbers up in rural Texas.
Though conservative rural Texas will be quite a lift, Jay Iyer of the University of Houston downtown says at the very least, Democrats need not to get swamped in the rural counties. But what they really need to do is run up big wins in the major urban centers and the suburbs.
The advantage still remains for President Trump, but this is definitely much closer than we've seen at any time since 1976.
That's the last time a Democrat won Texas in a presidential contest. Democrats do have some reason to be hopeful this time, according to Rebecca Dean, who chairs the political science department at UT Arlington.
They seem to be doing the right things with regard to party building that they've not
done in previous cycles. So they've learned from 2018. They have a much more solid ground game, and it appears to be that way across the state.
In 2018, the last statewide contest, former Congressman Beto O'Rourke lost to Senator Ted Cruz by less than 3 percentage points. But Republican political consultant Matt Mikowiak doesn't think midterm elections are a good predictor of presidential campaigns. And he's not convinced Democrats have the money they need to carry the state.
To run a statewide campaign in Texas, you would need at least $20 million. And really, at the presidential level, you probably need more like 30 to 40. So the most likely scenario is neither side will make significant statewide investments in Texas.
Mikowiak is also skeptical of polling that shows Biden tied with Trump here, saying most of it just focuses on registered voters. Still, at least one poll, Morning Consult, shows Biden with a 1-point lead among likely voters. Cameron Easley is a senior editor with the polling firm.
I think what this data shows today is certainly that, Texas is a much more competitive race than the Trump campaign wants it to be.
That's not something Democrats can take for granted, says Almeda Dent. She's another Democratic convention delegate from Houston.
From what I'm looking at, it just looks like Trump has a good chance of pulling Texas. I don't know if he's going to win across all of the United States, but it looks like he's going to win Texas. And that's sad.
Because Dent believes Democrats already have enough people registered to win the state if all of them actually voted. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Social media editor Wells Dunbar, how are you?
I'm great, Joy. Good to be with you today. We're hearing from folks about the big political news of the day, that kickoff to the Democratic National Convention Monday evening. We're hearing from some of the party faithful on Facebook there. Ihor Gauda says, I'm fired up and ready to go. Jaime Solorza says, simply vote Trump out. Taking a look here at the lineup for Monday, a bunch of bold face names there. Senator Bernie Sanders, Governor Andrew Cuomo, Senator Amy Klobuchar, former First Lady Michelle Obama. But as you and I were talking about, Joy, some of the news there, the names not in attendance.
The names not in attendance. That's what Texans care about. We care about the fact that neither Julian Castro nor Beto O'Rourke will be speaking at the convention. And they were his, presidential candidates as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, so no big marquee speeches, although I think you could say that the DNC has thrown a little bit of a bone to Texas Democrats. There's this thing, 17 rising leaders, and that includes U.S. Reps Colin Allred and Victoria Nieve. So
we're
going to see a little bit of Texas representation there at the DNC going forward this week.
Well, lots more to talk about, and I'm glad that you're monitoring the talk of Texas Online, Wells. When we come back, a lot more. The Texas Standard continues.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. A UTSA researcher says we're in the midst of a depressive pandemic, something she says she's measured using a tool you may have on your wrist right now. Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie explains.
On a scorching summer day in a park in San Antonio, even in the midst of a pandemic, people are counting their steps. Many use wearable devices like Fitbits to keep track of how much they move. But Fitbits also track other markers of health like sleep patterns and resting heart rate. That's why Dr. Amina Kutub has been using information gathered by these tools in her research at UTSA since 2018.
My lab is half experimental and half computational. We have this large-scale study called the Quantu Project, where we're focused on looking at brain health across a lifespan.
Volunteer participants in the Quantu Project wear Fitbits so Kutub's team can track their activity. And since many have been participating for well over a year, could have, is in a unique position to track physiological changes as the pandemic unfolds. So what is she finding?
There's a pandemic that's caused by the virus directly, but there's also a depressive pandemic. What I mean by that is you can obviously see from the quantitative data from the wearable devices that there is a huge number of people who are affected adversely in terms of their mental health by the pandemic and the stresses of the pandemic.
63 people are participating in GutHub's research related specifically to the pandemic.
We've identified 6 cohorts of people who are changing in very unique ways as a function of being exposed to the pandemic environment, meaning stay-at-home orders and their lifestyle changing. So among them are people who are changing the number of steps that they walk, their heart rate is increasing or their heart rate is decreasing. We also have a group where the amount they sleep in terms of rapid eye movement sleep has been changing at night.
GutHub is particularly interested in changes to REM sleep.
Rapid eye movement sleep is a type of sleep that's light sleep, and you go into it multiple times during a night. It is a signature of when your brain is able to repair itself and also consolidate memories. And this helps clear your brain of wastes, and it helps change your metabolism and rejuvenate yourself during the course of a night.
Changes to REM sleep have been linked to depression, and GutHub is seeing sometimes extreme disturbances. One volunteer increased their average REM sleep duration by 265% per night. So what about that reduction in activity she mentioned?
Overall, not surprisingly, 67% or so people have decreased their number of steps that they walk. So overall, there's more sedentary activity.
And then there's the group with the elevated resting heart rate compared to last year.
We're looking at it potentially as a signature for depressive episodes or for even COVID-19 itself.
GutHub notes that some of her volunteers are actually doing better. Those people are interesting to her team, too.
And what would be interesting as a follow-up is we'll look at the people who are ones that we're worried about and that we need to intervene with, but we also want to look at the people who are really positively changing in the pandemic and then really tailor interventions to an individual.
That's the ultimate goal, GutHub says, of this portion of her research, to figure out if there's a reliable way using physical metrics to determine when a person's mental health is starting to suffer and then figure out a way to help them get back on track again. I'm Bonnie Petrie in San Antonio.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Airlines are among the big companies that have been hit hardest by the pandemic, with business and leisure travel brought nearly to a standstill. And that obviously hits Texas hard, with some of the biggest players headquartered here, American, Southwest. After months of big hits to their bottom lines, carriers are adopting a strategy they hope will protect them from greater losses. They are hoarding cash. Joining us now is Andrew Hawkins. He's senior reporter for the tech news site The Verge. He and Sean O'Kane have been co-reporting on this story. Andrew Hawkins, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
So several of the major airlines, including two that are based in Texas, American, Southwest, reported earnings recently. But how is the pandemic affecting their bottom lines?
Well, so my colleague Sean and I dug into the earnings statements over the last quarter, and we found some interesting things. Well, first of all, all the airlines are losing a lot of money, and that's pretty obvious on its face. You know, the demand has dropped out. People are traveling obviously far less. Business travel has basically evaporated. So the big three, United, Delta, and American, they've lost about $10 billion over just the last 3 months.
Wow.
In addition to that, JetBlue lost $320 million, Southwest $915 million. It's staggering losses. But if you look a little bit deeper, you find that they're also taking in a lot of money through both direct payments from the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Securities Act, which was passed through Congress, as well as taking loans from some of the big banks. So we found that JetBlue took in around $936 million in payroll support from the CARES Act. And we also saw that American, based in Texas, is borrowing around $4.75 billion under this this legislation, along with $1.8 billion for payroll help and a $1.2 billion loan from Goldman Sachs. So wow. We're finding that they're losing a lot of money, but they're also hoarding a lot of money. And I think that that's, you know, they're going to be able to do a little bit of financial jujitsu, if you will, to hopefully survive the rest of the pandemic.
Okay. So how do they plan to use the money? Because when you're talking about those many billions of dollars, it's almost the amount that was that combined they all lost in the last quarter.
Well, they're hoping just to buy themselves some time for the most part. Obviously, they need to fill the gaps that they have in their own financial statements, you know, from the aforementioned losses that they're experiencing. But they're also hoping to avoid furloughs and layoffs. It seems like so far they're doing their best, but it seems like that it's not going to be sustainable in the long term. You know, as a provision of the CARES Act, they're supposed to be specifically for payroll support. So they're trying to pay workers to basically, you know, sort of keep their payroll level at a normal level. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be tough. Delta is already looking at 40,000 employees volunteering to take short-term unpaid leave. Mm-hmm. And I think American has also spoken about possibly shedding 25,000 jobs by October. And Southwest said recently in its own earnings call that they would not lay off or furlough any employees until October as well. So they're all just sort of trying to use this money to buy themselves some time in the hopes that the pandemic lessens and demand starts to tick back up.
I know that nobody knows really what the future holds, but what would it take for the airline business to improve? How long do you think they expect to be able to borrow money?
Well, I think a lot of it's going to rest on, you know, whether people feel confident to fly again. The airlines are trying to show that flying is safe. There has been research that shows that transmission of the virus is not as bad on planes as it can be in, so, you know, something like a music venue or a restaurant. So, you know, if they enforce their mask policy, they, you know, show that they're doing everything that they can to sanitize their planes. There is a possibility that they'll survive, and there has been some analysts, some trade groups that have shown that they expect normal demand to you know, sort of pre-pandemic demand to return possibly by 2023. So it's going to take a while.
Andrew Hawkins, he covers transportation at The Verge. He's a senior reporter there. Andrew, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, offering annual preventative and screening appointments with safety protocols in place. Early detection is critical to better cancer outcomes. More at TexasOncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The city of Austin is rolling out a second round of financial assistance for residents struggling to pay rent during the pandemic. Applications for the nearly $13 million rental fund opened Wednesday. Michael Gerber, who heads the local housing authority, described who's eligible during a virtual news conference today.
And finally, applicants must provide documentation showing that COVID-19 has impacted them, has affected them financially.
The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities estimates more than 1.5 million Texans are behind on rent statewide. Teachers in the third largest school district in Texas do not have to return to campus yet after winning the first round of a legal battle. Houston Public Media's Laura Eisensee has more on the lawsuit involving Cypress Fairbanks ISD.
Cypress School District administrators had ordered teachers to show up at their campuses last week for professional development for the new school year. Teachers asked the district to let them train virtually. Like many educators in the region and the country, they're concerned about their health and safety amid the coronavirus pandemic. When the district refused, the Cypress Teachers Union filed a lawsuit. For now, a Harris County judge has put a temporary halt to any in-person training. Another hearing is scheduled at the end of August. I'm Laura Eisensee in Houston.
Three detainees at an ICE facility in El Paso say they were sexually assaulted or harassed by guards. KERA's Mallory Falk reports two women and a man are making the allegations.
According to the complaint, one woman says two guards forcibly kissed her and touched intimate parts of her body on multiple occasions, out of view of security cameras. The others allege they were sexually harassed. Attorney Linda Corchado is calling for an investigation and has reached out to the local district attorney and federal prosecutors.
These victims provide a pattern of systematic predatory behavior exhibited by guards
A spokesperson for ICE said the agency is aware of the allegations and the Department of Homeland Security will investigate. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
And a dozen doctors at UT Austin's Dell Medical School say police should not use so-called less lethal munitions for crowd control because they can cause serious injuries. The group's commentary, published in the New England Journal of Medicine Friday, cites several head wounds caused by lead pellet bags officers fired during recent protests for racial justice in the Texas Capitol. The Austin Police Department has since said it won't fire the rounds into crowds. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. The booth where I am recording sits in the middle of the University of Texas at Austin, and it has a big window where I can see how students are starting to arrive for the fall semester. But here's a question for you. Shouldn't colleges and universities just cut their losses and call off the fall semester? Yasha Monk thinks so. He makes his case in a piece for The Atlantic, where he's a contributor. He's also associate professor of the practice of international affairs at Johns Hopkins University. Professor Monk, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much.
So many universities here in Texas, and I'm talking about the University of Texas, Texas A&M, they have announced plans to go mostly online, but they will have some in-person classes. Why don't you think that approach works?
Well, so obviously it depends on the local circumstances, and it may be appropriate to have a few students on campus. But there's a lot of universities that are asking a very significant number of students to come back this term. And look, I have spent much of my adult life on campuses. I'm a college professor. I love the excitement of having students on campus, you know, exploring intellectually, spreading their wings from their homes. It is, you know, a wonderful thing, and I'm heartbroken that many students will be missing out of that this term and this year. But when you look at how many cases of COVID-19 we have around the country, when you look at how strong an urge young students have to socialize and hang out with each other, I simply think that it'll prove impossible to contain outbreaks. And if universities have to close down precipitously and send all of their students scurrying back all across the country, they will then go and spread the virus again to all kinds of communities across the nation.
When you look at it that way, it's really, really difficult to argue against your case. But you also bring up a really interesting point that has to do with punitive measures, because some universities are saying, you know, no parties on campus, no parties outside of campus. And if you do, we're going to penalize you. How effective do you think those measures are?
I don't think they will be. I mean, you know, anybody who's been a teenager or anybody who has a teenager at home, you know, knows how they respond to rules and knows how much they like hanging out with their friends, which is normal and healthy for that age group. But the idea that people will actually really refrain from seeing their friends is unlikely. And some colleges, frankly, are simply living in a world of make-believe. You know, the idea that people will be able to go a whole term just seeing people socially who are in randomly assigned social pods, randomly assigned groups of 6 to 10 people, without seeing some of their closest friends from past terms and semesters, without being able to see somebody they might have a romantic relationship with. You know, whether colleges are relying on honor codes or whether they're relying on the threat of punitive punishment, I simply do not think that people will stick to those rules.
You know, I think all my life in the United States, I've lived in college campuses, first in Virginia, then here. And the thing about the college city or a city that depends heavily on a college is that most of the economy revolves around it. And so colleges know this, and they're caught between a rock and a hard place. So what do you say about that? I mean, what is the answer? What is the right thing to do? Is it truly to kill the fall semester and just think that maybe we can start over in January of 2021?
Yes, look, I mean, the economy of college towns is going to be very badly affected, and the economy of colleges themselves is going to be very badly affected. And I really wish that we were at a place at this point, as many countries around the world are, where the number of cases of COVID-19 is sufficiently low that you might be able to welcome students back and be much less likely to have an outbreak. But that's simply not the case. So at this point, we need to take the measures over the next 5 or 6 months to ensure that we contain the virus in the way that virtually every other developed democracy around the world has. And hopefully, by January, we may be starting to be in the phase where we're actually rolling out an effective vaccine against the coronavirus. And at that point, we can all return to normal life. And it's my deepest, most ardent desire that when I'm scheduled to teach again next spring, I'll be standing in front of a full lecture hall of students looking up at me and not, a few faces on Zoom. We all want to have campus again. We all want to have a social life off campus again. But right now, reopening college simply is too big a risk.
Yasha Monk is a contributor writer for The Atlantic. He's also associate professor of the practice of international affairs at Johns Hopkins University. Professor, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
Did you ever sit straight up in bed with something circling around your head and you swat at it as it whizzes by and it's just one pesky little fly? You shake your head and twitch your nose and settle down to sweet repose. And when you're just about to doze, fly trouble.
My name is Wizzy Brown and I'm with Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service and I work with insects.
Sphinx moths. So sphinx moths are also known by various names. They're known as hummingbird moths. They are also known in the caterpillar stage as hornworms. With the tomato hornworms, usually you have to make a decision on whether you want to have your tomatoes, which is usually what wins out at my house. You know, if somebody's going to eat my tomatoes, it's going to be me. But I know a lot of people that they won't kill the tomato hornworms on their tomatoes because they know they turn into these beautiful hummingbird moths. And it's just like, well, you know, if that's what you want to do. But that's not the way it works at my house. I kill the tomato hornworms. But there are other sphinx moths that don't necessarily cause damage. They just kind of hang out. Yes, the caterpillars are eating plants, but not to the levels that it's really going to cause an issue, or they may be on plants that we're not trying to eat, so it's not a problem. And there are some that are really, really cool in the adult form. They will mimic bumblebees. So a lot of times people mistake them for bumblebees, and there are other ones that get mistaken for hummingbirds, which is hummingbird moth is another name for them. Some species are going to be nocturnal, which is kind of the typical moth thing. The moths are usually out at night, and butterflies are usually the ones out during the day. But these ones are mostly nocturnal, but there are some are diurnal. And then the daytime flyers are usually the ones that are going to be mimicking the bees. And some of those have clear wings on the front, and so you can see through their wings and their bright yellow and black fuzzy bodies. But they can get, depending on the species, they can get like 5 or 6 inches in size. So they will be fairly large. A lot of these are going to have camouflage in the adult stage. So if you look at them, they are going to be kind of mottled browns or grays so they can blend in on trees and shrubs and things like that. But others are going to be mimics and get their protection that way. Those would be things that are mimicking stuff that can sting, like bumblebees. And then you have others that have these bright colors on them, but they're usually going to be on the underwings so they can flash those colors colors and give a startle response. If you ever get the chance to kind of sit down and watch bugs, which I'm sure everyone wants to do that, just sit down in the evening and you're going to watch for sphinx moths. And if you see them, they can actually hover. Some of them can move backwards, but their flying skills are just amazing. These moths are going to have kind of spindle-shaped bodies, so it's going to be tapered at the front and the back. And then they also kind of have spindle-shaped wings as well. And they just have a different look than most moths do. So think hummingbird, but being a moth. And it'll pretty much be what it is, but not the really gorgeous greens and purples and stuff that you see with hummingbirds.
I'm Wizzy Brown for the Texas Standard.
Wizzy Brown is a program specialist for the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service, and she's a resident insect expert. Something bugging you? Ask on social media or email texasstandard@kut.org. Suburban sprawl is nothing new to Texas, but in the West Texas town of Lubbock, where developments are pushing out the city's boundaries, a new grassroots group has an ambitious plan to preserve a historic part of the city. They call it Old Lubbock. From Texas Tech Public Media, Casey Ellingson has the story.
There's a part of the city that has a vibrant music scene in places like the Blue Light. This is where Buddy Holly grew up. It's home to Texas Tech University. The South Plains is known for its flat, dusty land, but patches of nature can be found if you look for it. This area of the city is laid out onto an incredibly simple grid, with a loop, Highway 289, surrounding it. This is Old Lubbock.
We slowly saw over time the city moving southwest, and then the further and further it moved southwest, you know, things got more and more decayed. As far as infrastructure, roads, opportunities, schools would close.
That's Adam Hernandez, born and raised in East Lubbock. He's 39 years old, and he's never even voted. But earlier this summer, he stood in front of the city council for the first time ever, as part of a group effort to preserve and revitalize Old Lubbock.
You'll have to excuse me, I'm not up too much on the technical terms. I'd like to start by saying that I speak for those citizens of Lubbock who are very rarely heard in these types of meetings.
He wears a graphic t-shirt with a picture of a sloth. Above it, the words, "Be slow to anger." But he is angry after reading the Lubbock Disparity Report, written by another Lubbock native, Nicholas Bergfeld, criticizing the way the city is expanding.
The fact that this kind of miraculous south and southwest growth was not because Lubbock had suddenly attracted a bunch of Dallas socialites, but that it represented the consolidation of the wealth of the city into defined neighborhoods. Whereas historically in Lubbock, something that had been such an essential component to our strength was the mixed income nature of our neighborhoods.
Within days of the report's release in June, a group formed on Facebook called the Lubbock Compact. More than 2,000 people have joined, including Natalie Ayers.
It's not just the East Lubbock and North Lubbock issue, it's a Lubbock issue, because it's bringing truth to the situations and really just getting the community engaged.
The group's been busy discussing strategy on their Facebook page and holding Zoom webinars to untangle complex policy issues, like one-time fees for development, known as impact fees. They're hoping to convince the city to remove fees for development in Old Lubbock and increase those fees for construction in newer parts of the city.
I think that Compact Lubbock group has, in one aspect, been effective in their efforts advocating for, I think, what they call Old Lubbock.
That's Lubbock Mayor Dan Pope.
But just the idea that we can't outgrow where we came from. One of the most difficult parts of this job, if not the most difficult, is the how you embrace growth while at the same time taking care of what you have.
The mayor is caught in the middle of Old and New Lubbock. He represents not only members of the Lubbock Compact Group, but also developers like Jordan Wheatley. Wheatley grew up in Lubbock and has seen it grow beyond the cotton fields that surrounded it.
Right now, where all the construction activity where you're seeing is just where there is a demand.
David Driscoll is the director of Urban Tech Design Center at Texas Tech and is a former urban designer. He challenges the idea that there's no demand for development in Old Lubbock.
You don't have a choice of living in a new house inside the loop. They're not offering the choices.
So no, they are not building to the demand. They are the demand. What they build is the only choice.
Driscoll is a fan of the mayor, but agrees with the report that ignited Lubbock Compact.
I'm with the report 100%, is that we have to develop pretty much within inside the loop and within our infrastructure. You've got to let neighborhoods tell you what they want.
That's what Nicholas Bergfield and the Lubbock Compact are fighting for.
I love the city. The potential for this city to be one of America's greatest is so high.
In a nod to what the group hopes for, the city's pending budget includes the hiring of a neighborhood planner for East and North Lubbock. I'm Casey Ellingson in Lubbock.
Peggy Sue, Peggy Sue, oh how my heart yearns for you, oh Peggy.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. There's been lots of news involving the U.S. Postal Service as of yet, but here's an idea. What if the U.S. Postal Service could be reimagined to become part of the healthcare system? And what if, in the process, USPS received a booster shot of income? The idea is not mine. I wish it was, but it is Dr. Michael Piñones, internal medicine doctor, chair of the Department of Internal Medicine at UT's Dell Medical School. He's also the interim chair of population health at UT's Dell Medical School, and he recently wrote a commentary for the Journal of General Internal Medicine. Dr. Michael Piñones, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
In your commentary, you talk about the reliability and affordability of the Postal Service and how it gets to hard-to-reach areas delivering even by donkey. How did you get the idea that USPS could be reimagined?
Well, part of the idea came from seeing what we've observed during the COVID epidemic. For all the terrible things that have happened with COVID, one bright spot has been that we've broken down some of the barriers to delivering care outside of the doctor's office. And when you think about how best to deliver care, going to the patient rather than making the patient come to us is a really appealing concept. We had developed a colon cancer screening program that mailed colon cancer screening tests to people here in Austin. But with COVID, I started to think, man, maybe we could do this on a bigger scale. And that's what led to this essay.
And one of the things that I was thinking about is that you emphasize the affordability of this. I mean, really, when we're talking about the healthcare system, there's nothing that we can point to and say, oh, that's affordable.
That's a really important point. You know, someone might ask, well, couldn't FedEx or UPS do the same thing? And for some things, maybe they could, but the low cost and highly distributed aspect of the Postal Service, the fact that it serves even our most rural residents in a state like Texas, is really appealing. So for instance, in our colon cancer screening program, only about 20 to 25% of the people that we mail out to respond. But that's more than enough for a cost-effective intervention when the initial mailing can be done at low cost like we can with the USPS.
Right. I wanted to go into a little bit more detail with this. What do you call this colorectal screening?
Yeah, the test is called the FIT, which is the fecal immunochemical test, where people send in stool samples and we check them for microscopic amounts of blood. We've mailed FIT tests to over 30,000 Austinites, found a number of people with cancer and a number of people with precancerous polyps, where we've been able to remove those polyps and therefore prevent future cancers. And then, of course, treat the people who are identified with cancer at an earlier stage.
What you're telling me is that people actually ship their poop to you all.
Yeah, in a very safe way, right back to the lab where the tests are processed. And then the results sent back to the patient. That's really kind of the easier to imagine part of expanding the Postal Service's role as part of our essential healthcare workforce. Kind of the more extreme is actually the postal workers themselves beginning to deliver healthcare.
Oh, well, that's one thing that I was going to ask you is in an ideal world, what would the final product look like, this interaction? Well,
yeah, I think imagining going forward, their widely distributed network and their local knowledge of communities could be repurposed, for instance, to could postal workers be delivering our flu vaccine or perhaps the new COVID vaccine when we want to disseminate it quickly? The government has thought about this already. When they developed some of the response plans, for instance, to bioterrorism, the Postal Service was one of the entities that was going to deliver the life-saving antibiotics to people if there was a mass anthrax attack. In France, they've used the Postal Service to do checks on isolated elderly people living alone so that someone is looking in on that person every day to make sure that they haven't fallen or they haven't gotten sick and not been able to communicate with someone. That is a kind of more radical reimagining of the Postal Service, but one that might really provide a future funding stream that would preserve its existence and its and allow it to thrive.
Dr. Michael Pignone is an internal medicine doctor, and he's also the chair of the Department of Internal Medicine at UT's Dell Medical School. He's also the interim chair of population health at the same school. Doctor, thank you so much for this.
My pleasure.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Thank you for joining us again. Wells Dunbar is the social media editor. How are you, Wells? You are, I'm sure, busy listening and looking and reading.
A lot to keep track of, Joy, but always a pleasure to be with you and so much to talk about, really specifically in relation to this, to the post office. We just heard about that fascinating potential rethinking of the post office in line with the healthcare, but the slowdown and potential sabotage of the Postal Service dominating headlines.
Yeah.
I guess the latest development on that front, House Democrats have called on Postmaster General Louis DeJoy to testify at an oversight committee newly scheduled for August 24th, next Monday, to examine the vast changes on USPS and mail-in voting. We've just to recap briefly, we've heard about new rules prohibiting mail from going out at the end of the day, things like mail sorting machines being ripped out of post office depots and whatnot. So obviously has a lot of folks talking. On our Facebook page, Linda Pallett says, the U.S. mail is a service, not a for-profit business, and it hurts citizens to slow down the mail. Many people get Social Security checks, other checks, and prescription drugs by mail. What an insult to U.S. citizens not to support the post office.
Yeah, there were some very difficult to watch photos on the Washington Post where all the mailboxes have been removed in several streets in New York. And it's like, you know, coming from another country, I just have always valued the Postal Service that is so reliable everywhere, you know, that you get your stuff. But
I know, and really a lifeline to so many small Texas towns. You know, speaking of the Washington Post, you just mentioned seeing this headline just crop up from a name familiar to folks on the 40 acres there at UT Austin, William McRaven, former Navy SEALs captain and former chancellor of the UT system. He's got a new opinion piece apparently in the Washington Post headline, "The Country's Future Could Hinge on Postal Workers." Quick takeaway from that. He writes, quote, "Today, as we struggle with social upheaval, soaring debt, record unemployment, a runaway pandemic, and rising threats from China and Russia, Trump is actively working to undermine every major institution in this country," and really a clarion call to continue to fund USPS and keep the Postal Service strong. You know, quickly, I would also add that we heard late last week that about several states where voting could potentially be impacted by the slowdown in mail, and our home station KUT Austin pointing out that Texas is indeed one of those states that was notified of the potential for mail-in ballots to be delayed due to the slowdown in mail processing.
I am so glad that you touched on all of those points, Wells. From our story, you know, the reimagining, you know, doing wellness checks instead of the police, that's interesting. And so many other ideas that we could have for this beloved institution. So we'll see what happens on Capitol Hill. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be here tomorrow, and we hope you are too, on behalf of the entire team. And Jake Perlman, our visiting engineer, we thank you for being here. This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam,
and the George Huntington family.